This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
From the state-of-the-art L-shaped studios at beautiful and serene Hoho Loon Plaza in Vancouver, British Columbia. Greg Phillips and Nick Duke are the hard-traveling fanboys.
Welcome, everyone, to the hard-traveling fanboys. I am Greg. With me, as always, is my buddy Nick. We are here in the L-shaped studio, Hoho Loon Plaza, beautiful and serene Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, to bring you the return of our much-requested series, Hard Travelers for Hire. This is, of course, our movie-by-movie trek through the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And today, joining us to talk about Spider-Man Homecoming is the greatest and biggest fan of Spider-Man that I know, one, Russell Bartholomew Sellers. Russell, that's not your real middle name, but what if it were?
It would be the greatest middle name in history. It would be the best middle name anyone has ever had.
I agree.
I'd own it. But thank you for bringing me back for what is one of my my favorite iterations of Spider-Man, and you know it's been a little while since I've seen it, so I'm curious to see how old Andrew Garfield picks up after that little cliffhanger there at the end of the last one with his father being alive.
Yeah, I know, Nick, that one of the things that you and I were hoping to see in this movie is what becomes of Norman Osborn's head, and does it in fact survive in a jar?
Yeah, that's definitely – I was awaiting that with bated breath for sure. We will just have to wait and see, will we not?
Yeah, we will. We will. And as you know, anybody that listens to our Hard Traveler series is the same as with Off the Page. We like you to be able to watch the movie with us. Now, we're not going to watch the entire movie tonight, but what we do is we put on the movie or the TV show to kind of guide us through talking points, remind us of things we haven't mentioned yet, performances, aspects of the film that stand out. So if you would like to watch along with us, we recommend you get the movie, set it up, and maybe pause the podcast for a minute. We have our movies ready and raring to go. And so once you get your copy of Spider-Man Homecoming pulled up and ready to play, you can press that play button in 3, 2, 1, play. So we talked about just last month, in fact, I think, Nick, or maybe it was 2 months ago, we talked about Spider-Man, The Amazing Spider-Man 2, and how, to quote our good friend Mr. Garner, it left bad taste in mouth. So from the ashes of that came this deal where Disney and Sony decided to make nice and essentially share ownership of the Spider-Man character, allowing him to finally be brought into the Marvel Cinematic Universe. This meant starting over with a young Spider-Man again, this time played by Tom Holland, a British actor who was heretofore mostly unknown, at least to me. What did you guys think about the decision to reboot the Spider-Man franchise yet again? I know at the time it was somewhat controversial because we had just had a reboot not that long before.
I was absolutely for it. I mean, you almost had to. After The Amazing Spider-Man 2, that version of the character was completely untouchable. There was no salvaging that. And so outside of going back to 2007 with Spider-Man 3, there's just not a whole lot you could do. So I understood the reason for rebooting, and I was absolutely for it, especially when news started to trickle out that it was going to feature an even younger Peter Parker than we had ever seen before, which, as you guys know, is something that made me very excited. And also made our good friend Tim Cable very excited as well.
yes, I love the callback to that. I'm kind of in the same boat. I did have some trepidation about it because it, as Greg, as you pointed out, this was going to be our second reboot in under a decade. So it was one of those things where I was like, you know what? If it was going to anybody other than Kevin Feige and the folks working at Disney, and you know, of course in the MCU, I probably would have balked at it. I would have said that this is just going to be another bad attempt at by Sony, and they're going to continue to fuck up my favorite character. But as history has shown, that was thankfully not the case here, and Spider-Man proved to be in very capable hands.
Yes, those capable hands, of course, being the aforementioned Kevin Feige, Marvel Studios, and all of the associated people therein, and also in the hands of a studio and a company that had to that point renovated a lot of characters that were not A-listers. So now the MCU and Kevin Feige are gaining control of a true A-list character from Marvel, unquestionably Marvel's most famous, most popular character. And here to take on this project, they went with director John Watts. Now, he, I guess, became relatively famous for his show, his films Clown and Cop Car, and his work on Onion News Network. Now, still, a little bit of an unknown quantity to get control of a character like Spider-Man. Were you guys familiar at all with his work before doing Spider-Man?
I had heard of Cop Car, still have not seen it. I haven't really watched any of his other work, so I was aware of the name, but had no idea what his work would actually look like. So it was one of those things where I did come in with a little bit of hesitance just based on the unknown quantity. But I would say I had most of my concerns alleviated once the movie started.
Yeah, I didn't know much about him either, but I didn't really have concerns because Marvel at this point is kind of notorious for not really pulling A-list directors for their films. I mean,
that's true.
The Ryan Coogler deal is kind of the exception to the rule. For the most part, yeah. You know, now that the MCU has been established, they're going to go with directors who don't enjoy as high a profile and likely directors that can't command as much control over the story and kind of have to fit within the larger plan that Kevin Feige is laying out. So I didn't really have any concerns from that perspective.
And you could even argue that the MCU has made the careers of a few directors, namely the Russo brothers,
mm-hmm.
who were nobody before they got Captain America: The Winter Soldier.
Yeah, absolutely. And to a degree, I think he had a career beforehand, but certainly they've elevated the profile of Taika Waititi as well. Sure. And so it's they tend to have a history of doing that with directors. Now, the interesting thing about this movie is even though it was a huge success and even though it's so well enjoyed, I don't hear his name mentioned a lot. Like, he doesn't seem like a buzzy director, which is strange because I thought he did a really strong job with this film.
He's probably like so entrenched now in the Spider-Man mythos because he is directing the Homecoming sequel, mm-hmm. that's probably taking up a good bit of his time currently. Though, if the Homecoming sequel does turn out to be as good as we all hope and think it will be, I think there's a strong possibility he'll get bigger work after that. Maybe even within Disney or with another studio. I'm sure somebody's courting him by now. Because as you pointed out, Greg, this movie was a very good success for a Spider-Man, for the Spider-Man franchise, because I certainly don't think that it could have gotten much lower from where it was, coming on the heels of Amazing Spider-Man 2. Right. And what do you guys think of think about this opening here, like after we've gotten through the prequel scene of tying this world into the Avengers and the introduction of Adrian Toomes, the Vulture. Now Peter is like filming a video diary. And I gotta say, even though I love all of this, like showing us the kind of the behind the scenes of the of what would tie into Civil War, it weirded me out a little bit because I was like, who in the hell are you going to show this to? Please tell me you're not live streaming this.
Yeah, it was a little – I thought it was a bit of an interesting choice given that they even – first of all, I thought it was really fun. I thought it was great, especially the most recent rewatch I did of it. I really enjoyed it. However, I did think it was kind of interesting. They address it on there. We're happy saying you can't show this to anyone. And he goes, oh, I know. And he's like, why are you doing the voice? Oh, because it's fun. But I think there's an element of weirdness in terms of filming something only for yourself. I guess it happens, but – are you laughing at the movie or are you laughing at the implications of the filming? I'm laughing at
your comment and its relation to certain things that have been discussed in our legendary Place for Nation Comics group chat that I'll leave right there.
So I get where that's coming from. So to speak.
Greg says as his voice cracks.
Yep. just waiting on those text messages, boys.
That's good shit.
Recording of oneself. Yeah, it was a little weird. And Nick, what were your thoughts on that segment?
I like the opening. It seems like something that a weird, 14-15-year-old kid would do in this day and age where they feel like they have to record and document everything, even if they're not really going to show it to anybody. They constantly have their phones out. They're constantly doing this kind of shit. I kind of dug it. And plus, it gave us the awesome Jon Favreau stuff, which is one of the, like, most underutilized bits in this entire movie, the Peter Happy dynamic. So I was all for this.
I love all of the Tony Stark stuff. This Tony Stark scene is amazing to me with him and Peter in the car. I think this is awesome. Great chemistry between Robert Downey and Tom Holland carrying over from Civil War. Maybe I need to go back and watch the Iron Man movies because I don't remember Happy coming off like this much of an asshole in any of the Iron Man movies. Am I nuts?
In Iron Man 3, you got to remember he was very overbearing as the head of security or whatever. And so you kind of got the impression that he was pretty much only friends with Pepper and Tony, and he hated everybody else, which has kind of always been his character in the comics that they play up, that he's only called Happy because he always looks so
– Sure, yeah.
He has the owl on his face.
There's also the element here that Tony is assigning him to kind of sort of be Peter's babysitter, honestly, in this whole situation. So, yeah, he's a bit resentful of that because he's gone from head of security for Stark to glorified babysitter for this budgeting wannabe superhero who, quite frankly, has no idea what he's doing and is constantly filming himself. So, yeah, I'm sure he's annoyed.
and also, look at this list of text messages.
Yes, he's going to blow up Happy's phone continuously. Look at all the texts.
If you made me hang out or watch after a 14- or 15-year-old kid all the time, I would be annoyed and pissed off all the time, too. Well, so look for that in about 10 years.
In about 10 years.
Yep. Yeah, let that countdown begin.
Well, let me rephrase, Nick. In about 12 years. maybe they'll flip-flop personalities by then. We'll see.
We'll see. Hello?
Nonetheless, yes.
Greg Parker, this is not thirst trap hour. Come on, we're doing a podcast. Keep up.
I'm trying to remember the name of the damn character. The Vulture. My God, the Vulture. Now you guys have been doing the award-winning, not yet award-winning, but soon to be award-winning Marvel Age podcast here for Place to Be Nation Pop, and I know you guys have encountered the early stages of the Vulture, a comic book character that I must confess I always thought was impossibly corny due to the fact that he was just so old.
Everybody thinks that the Vulture is lame. Like, there's not really been, that I've read anyway, a good version of the Vulture. Not even the Ultimate version is anything that I would call good. Because, I mean, essentially, he's been presented, especially in that early stuff that we're reading from, that we read from Marvel Age, as, you know, flying Mr. Magoo that's a Spider-Man villain. He's drawn
yeah, pretty much
to be like a 95-year-old man, and there's nothing physically intimidating about him. And the only thing he can really do is he can fly using this suit, but like has no strength, super strength, doesn't really in the comics have this amazing technology or anything. He should be somebody that Spider-Man should handle easily. So if there was an area about this movie that I was trepidatious about coming in, when they announced the Vulture was going to be the villain, that was my biggest area of concern. I was terrified.
The biggest concern with that is how do you find an actor to play the Vulture? Because the actors who are old enough to play the Vulture convincingly are all suffering from dementia at this point.
Yeah, Kirk Douglas was not going to be able to remember his lines. I mean, that's pretty much why he was out.
Yeah. So, but thankfully they changed course on us.
Right. Do you have a Kirk Douglas impression, by the way?
I'd have to watch a Kirk Douglas movie again to get one.
Not from a movie. I'm talking about like old dementia ridden Kirk Douglas.
That I have not heard. I've not conversed with old dementia ridden Kirk Douglas.
Well, and even if you had, he wouldn't remember it.
I have talked to The Rock. The Rock said he expected a mixed reaction for our old man Kirk Douglas jokes.
I love all the teachers in this movie, by the way, with their terrible teacher jokes. Like this guy, I promise it won't be boring.
Yep.
But every teacher in this movie is like someone. Every teacher in this movie is that guy, like who's a bit player in so many other things that mildly recognize them.
My favorite is the guy that's in charge of detention, where he says, "Hey, wait. What are you doing?" And he just lets him off, you know?
Yes.
He just does not care.
Could not care less. Which, for those of us who went through the public school system in Alabama, I think we've had a few teachers like that over our years.
Feels very authentic. That's one of the biggest compliments I can pay to this movie is that it feels very authentic to the high school experience.
Yeah. Yep. Much more so than a lot of movies, because I think a lot of movies tend to play up the exaggerated notion of high school, and for the most part, this one kind of avoids a lot of that. It doesn't fall into some of the, for lack of a better way to express it, making high school seem more interesting than it is. they don't really fall into a lot of those traps by artificially manufacturing drama.
Also love that little bit here that we're just seeing with Peter just tapping his hands like he's anxious to get out of this school so he can go and do his Spider-Man swinging around thing. Like they're really playing up the one of the angles and one of the aspects I love most about the character is that he can't wait to get in that suit because that is where his joy is.
Mm-hmm. And so. The redefining of the Vulture that we mentioned a minute ago, Michael Keaton, classic comic book character, Michael Keaton, who played Batman in 1989, I think that you were with us for our review of that movie, Russell.
I was.
And obviously an iconic portrayal that will be remembered for ages as Batman. Here he is playing not just a comic book villain, but a Marvel villain, and going opposite probably the third most famous superhero behind only Batman and Superman is Spider-Man. So it's kind of an incredible turnaround. And not just doing that, but Michael Keaton, who's kind of been off the radar for many years in terms of mainstream films, coming here, he had obviously had Birdman that brought him back in terms of award season material. But he comes here, plays this huge role in Spider-Man Homecoming, and gives us what I think we would all agree is the very best version of the Vulture there's ever been.
Easily.
And one of the best Marvel villains that we've seen.
Yeah, just continued the run of great Marvel villains that they were kind of on at this point. Vulture was something I did not anticipate a take like this at all on the character. So it completely redefined him for me to the point where I don't even know that the comics could find a way to reconcile the previous comics version with this version. They'd almost have to just have a brand new Vulture modeled after this version of Adrian Toomes to even make it work. But yeah, outstanding performance by Michael Keaton, brings a level of empathy and a level of menace, especially in a scene I know we're going to talk about later on. So, yeah, I was blown away by Michael Keaton in this movie.
Can we talk about how freaking awesome the Spider-Man suit is?
Mm-hmm.
It's great.
This is like unlike anything we've seen up to this point. And it's a little thing, but it's something that kind of means a lot to me. And seeing the eye lenses being able to expand and contract.
Yes, very Ditko. Yeah. Yeah.
Like they respond to his eyes so that he can focus in a little bit more. I mean, people can say what they want about the suit having too much in it. Like it's too tech heavy for a classic Spider-Man. I really give zero shits about that because this is my favorite spider suit up to this point.
I have to admit, I did not like the bearded guy just now. He came off to me a little bit like turn himself in guy.
It's just one of those odd moments in Queens. Although I like this, how this dude is having to break into his own car in Spider-Man.
Right, yeah,
he thinks he's a thief and completely fucks this up because he's young. He has no idea. He's just being a reactionary superhero. And here comes a really great
Stanley cameo. Yep.
Don't make me come down there, you punk.
You punks. Hey, Marjorie, how's your mother?
Yes.
Yeah, so good.
And I love how Tom Holland may be British, but whenever he's in the spider suit, he turns on a very authentic sounding Queens accent.
It's almost like he goes harder into the accent when he's in the suit than he does.
Oh, he does. That's how he's disguising himself, is by not speaking with the accent whenever he's out of the suit, but speaking very heavily with it when he's in. So it can. It's a. You know, I feel like that's a much better thing to do than like trying to lower or gruff up your voice.
Yeah, and we actually get a little bit of a poking fun at that scene later on in the movie where he does the he goes into intimidating interrogation mode, and his voice affects this bizarre, like it's like you took the robo, it's like you took the Batman or the Arrow voices, and then you like threw them through the Robo Greg translator and came out with something on the other side.
Oh, it's so good. And it doesn't work at all on Donald Glover's character. He just kind of – he looks at him like, that's not you, man. That's so weird. It's like, I've heard you talk.
Here we have the first big action scene in the movie, and that's something that I wanted to talk about in the movie because, spoiler alert for the later in the show, one of my nitpicks with this movie will be the fight scenes and the action set pieces, but I will say I thought this was great. This is a really great introduction to Spider-Man's personality and his powers and the way that he has fun with this. And quite frankly, the Avengers here, I got to say, Thor's been letting himself go.
Yeah, absolutely. As Spider-Man says here in a moment, not as attractive as he thought he would be. this is a fun scene. Like it's highlighting how differently Spider-Man handles, you know, these sorts of things than your average superhero, more with, this weird sense of playfulness as opposed to taking it like serious business all the time.
Right. And again, another, not that we haven't seen lighthearted fare in the MCU, we've seen with Guardians, Iron Man, but, in the wake of something like Civil War, where we saw Spider-Man in a movie that was very much with comedy elements, but a serious movie, a movie that was dealing with emotional themes. Spider-Man is a character that, in general, while his personal life is hell and he has a hard time navigating it, as Spider-Man, he has fun. That's when he can actually let loose and get away from the fact that he's living with his aunt and, seemingly alone except for his friend that we'll talk about in a bit. Avengers Tower still exists for the time being. Stark is selling it and Happy selling off the things. What did you guys think of what I thought was one of the cooler parts of the movie, the seamless way that it played off of Civil War? It's even though this is a launch of a new series, it ties in so closely with what we've seen in Civil War. And I know that approach doesn't always work and it would be easy for it to fail. But in this case, I think they do it just enough, and they do it in the right way with the right characters, Happy Hogan and Tony Stark, to really make this work and to plant the seeds for something we're going to see throughout the MCU and particularly paid off in Infinity War with regards to the father-son dynamic between Tony and Peter.
Oh, it's perfectly balanced. And that's one of the things that I can say about this movie, I think, that really sticks out to me, even amongst its MCU peers, is that this movie finds a way to balance its own story in the larger context of the MCU, so it feels like it's part of that universe. You never forget that it is, but it never loses sight of the most important aspect, and that is telling its own story, keeping it focused on the character that you are learning about, the star of this movie. It's not like, hey, let's get into all the continuity weeds and make that into our primary focus. This ain't an Avengers movie. This is a Spider-Man movie first. And even if you haven't seen Civil War, I still feel like you could come into this movie and you'd be just fine. The little bits at the beginning will catch you up. I think everybody knows Spider-Man's origin by now. So thankfully we skipped that. We go right to Peter's been Spider-Man for a while, and now Ned Leeds completely drops his Death Star and destroys it right here in this wonderful, wonderful scene.
So, just playing off of what you were mentioning there, yes, 100%. Yes, I'm so glad they didn't go with the origin route, because it would have been so easy to do, so lazy to do. And again, Spider-Man, as I will always say, is one of those characters that everybody knows his origin. Every single person knows his origin. So, but Nick, I know sometimes you're a lot more lenient on origin movies and their necessity than I am. So what were your thoughts on that? Do you think they should have gone the origin route, or do you think in this case they made the right call?
No, it's fine not to go the origin route. I wish we had, you know, some sort of even a brief flashback just to know what the context and kind of what this version of the origin look like. Like, Uncle Ben's going to be a young man, and they're essentially, you know, a younger man in this version of it. I would like to see what that looks like. I would like to, you know, I love the Spider-Man origin so much. I would like to see what the MCU version of it looks like. But I can't sit here and say,
I'm going to spoil it for you. Spider-Man does a selfish thing that costs Uncle Ben his life.
I said what it looks like, Greg, not to hear what your description of it is. The actual visuals of it. I'm sorry if that was confusing for you at all. But in any event, I can't sit here and say they made a mistake by not doing the origin, because I love this movie and wouldn't really change that much about it.
Nick, do you really need to see Bruce's mom's pearls again? Is that something you'd like to see as well?
No, not really. Unless it was the MCU doing it, and then yeah, I'd probably watch it.
What if it were Christopher Nolan rebooting a Batman franchise?
Yes, absolutely. Give me the pearls. If Chris Nolan wants to do another Batman movie and wants to make 90 minutes about the pearls, sign me the fuck up.
What you're saying is you would allow Christopher Nolan to deliver to you a film about Batman's origin?
Yes.
Okay, good. And a pearl necklace.
Yes, and multiple pearl necklaces even. That could be the take.
Now, that you don't want to ask too much of them. Come on.
Well, I'm just saying.
Pearl necklaces aside, here's Aunt May, played for the first time by a not old person.
Yeah, well, she briefly appeared, of course, in Civil War. So, yeah, that was the biggest bit of casting that came out about this movie that made me feel not trepidatious, but just uncomfortable, because I maintain that I should not want to have sex with Aunt May.
And yeah, it's one of those weird moments in life where we've always understood things to be one way, and it's that Aunt May is always on the verge of death. She is always at death's door. Things got a little bit further away from that whenever we got the Amazing Spider-Man reboot, and we had, of course, Sally Field playing Aunt May. Mm-hmm. She was younger.
She was, yeah.
It's good. Somewhat younger, anyway. I mean, she was believable to be Andrew Garfield's aunt. Like, I bought that.
Yeah, younger than Rosemary Harris, but I wouldn't classify her as younger, you know?
No, well, sure. Like, younger than Rosemary Harris wasn't like – she didn't look like she was on the verge of going to the home, right? You know? but when it came to Marissa Tomei, I was right there with you. I was like, now I feel
– weird.
It's like – because I know that Marissa Tomei is older now. This is not the same. Marissa Tomei is not the same age that she was in My Cousin Vinny, but by God, has she aged well.
Yeah.
And I am older, so I feel a little less bad about it, but at the same time, it's like, this is just one of those situations where I guess I'm just going to have to be okay with having a hot Aunt May.
Yeah, well, it's weird because if you think about it, we're at the age now where we're closer to being an uncle figure than we are to being in high school.
Yeah, we're on the cusp of that, so now it's starting to feel like, oh, God, the day that Aunt May becomes age-appropriate for us.
Exactly, and in this case, yes, hot Aunt May is officially a thing, as played by Marissa Tomei.
The only thing that this movie could have done that would have made all of this better is to play up that undeniable chemistry between Robert Downey Jr. and Marissa Tomei.
Yes, they're so great. Complete with that original video message from Tony at the beginning of the film when he's
oh,
like,
God, yes.
Yeah, it's like, what are you wearing? Something, or what is it? Something
skimpy.
Lacy. Yeah, skin tight. Skimpy. Hope, yeah. Yep. So
I also love that the kids here are playing Fuck, Marry, Kill with the Avengers.
Yeah, so by the way, let's play that right now.
Oh, come on. This is the easiest thing of all time.
Well, I know who your Mary would be, but I don't know your F or
that's
your
easy.
A.
That's easy. So what you do is you fuck Iron Man and you film it and hold it over his head and blackmail him for lots of money. Then you marry Thor and you kill the Hulk so you don't have to take that massive green thing. So yeah, that's the easiest fuck, marry, kill of all time.
Well, wouldn't you though get more of a benefit out of marrying Iron Man long term? And just having a side relationship with Thor?
No. I mean, this man is a raging alcoholic and a prima donna. Thor, you know, Thor is going to be there with you forever. He is going to provide you a true lifelong companion.
Yeah, until you're dead and he keeps going on and then
somebody else. And that's all fine and well and good because I'm dead at that point. What do I care?
You'll be going to Valhalla at that point.
Well,
I'm
not
have to look down at Thor banging all these other people.
And I'll say good for him. He probably deserves it because he's so much better than I am.
Yeah, but Valhalla is the land of dead heroes. Can you imagine what you're going to have in there?
Yeah, that's true, I suppose. You know, there's probably some other dead Norse gods there that you can
mate
with. So you know, I think it depends on the prenup. If there's a prenup, then certainly, you know, you can feel free. You know, maybe you marry Thor, you fuck Iron Man, and you kill Hulk. However, I'm going into a world where Tony Stark loves me so much that he doesn't make me sign a prenup. Then I marry Iron Man, I fuck Thor, and again, I think Hulk is the one you kill here in this scenario. If you can. Russell, your thoughts?
Well, the game assumes that you can, so you have to play by those rules.
Because what if you try to kill him and you don't? He's the one that I would least want.
The game is not try to kill Hulk. The game is kill Hulk. It's not
okay.
There's no wiggle room in the parameters of the game.
I'm just saying, I want 100% kill on him. That's all I'm saying.
Kill is kill in this context.
And speaking of games, sort of. Look at this massive fucking house that they're having a party in right now.
Yeah. I always thought Peter Parker was supposed to be in like a, you know, maybe not the wealthiest area of kids, but somebody lives in a goddamn mansion.
This version of Peter attends a magnet school that is based on their intelligence. Yes. So it explains the disparity in incomes.
And yeah, this girl Liz Allen that he's totally crushing on, yeah, this is her place. So. Mm-hmm. Her parents' house, anyway. And, yeah.
How do you pay for all of that, one wonders?
Spoiler alert. And I'll say this. I avoided these spoilers going into this movie the first time. Thanks. So whenever the swerve hits, it hit me hard. It hit like a fucking ton of bricks that her dad is the Vulture.
Yeah, it's – so that's a good – good. Let's get to that right now. I know that happens later in the film. But to me, when I think back to all of the MCU movies, one of maybe the best in terms of twists or things that I didn't see coming that just like got me when it happened was the reveal of when Peter walks in the house and realizes that Liz's dad is the Vulture. I thought it was such a good scene. That and its follow-up when they're driving in the car later on, which I think Nick was referring to earlier, which is my favorite scene in the movie. Mm-hmm. I think they're both brilliant scenes. Mm-hmm. Michael Keaton's amazing. Tom Holland's amazing. The setup, because I did not – again, like Russell said, I'm not going to make up the fact, oh, I saw it coming. No, no, I did not see it coming. It bombarded me and blindsided me in a very, very good way, and – it actually made my skin crawl because I was thinking, oh, my God, what happens now? There's so many ways they could go from here. From a storytelling perspective, I was like, gosh, there's so many places they could go here.
That was great. The golf course bit is fantastic.
Yes, I absolutely love that they did this because he's out in the suburbs. He's going to try and swing away, and he is, I'm in a place where there is nothing for me to swing from. What do? I have to run. I mean, that's a joke that I think all of us have thought of at some point or another. We just never see anybody really attempt it, and it worked wonderfully on screen here. I absolutely loved that bit. It was like a short fan animation that was made a couple of years ago where Spider-Man is perched on top of a building or what looks like just a rooftop. You can't tell where he is. He hears somebody yell for help, and he stands up, and he runs to the edge of the building, jumps up and shoots a web, and falls straight to the ground because there's nothing around him. He's at a farmhouse.
Yeah, where do those webs go, for God's sake?
Yeah, exactly. It's like if the web has nothing to stick to, what's he going to do? But here's another action scene that I think actually works pretty well, showing that Spidey is up against, you know, tech that he is – I mean, it's his second encounter with this tech that he's just not prepared for, and of course it's adapted from the Chitauri from the Avengers. The salvage company that Adrian Toomes was running was basically overtaken by – it wasn't S.H.I.E.L.D., but it was all run by Tony Stark. Because he was trying to, you know, gather up all the alien tech, but they wound up stealing some of it, modifying weapons, and now they're selling them, you know, black market style. And of course, Vulture's suit is kind of made from all this stuff. So he's not only a spokesman, he's a client.
Indeed, and Spider-Man is having to go up against an individual who was going to shock the world.
Yes,
he of course is going up against the shock.
And I actually very much appreciated that you Shocker the way they did, because mm-hmm. Shocker, quite frankly, is not a leading villain.
No, Shocker was always a jobber. Basically, he was somebody that was above the level of your common thug, but not much above it, and always used as cannon fodder for the mob bosses and whatnot.
Speaking of things this movie does differently from every other MCU movie, it totally takes cues from John Hughes movies. And this scene you're seeing right now is a big example of that, because this is taken straight out of Ferris Bueller's Day.
Ferris Bueller, yep.
And this is a great scene. And somebody's watching Ferris Bueller on a television there to mm-hmm. drive that point home. Love the pool bit where he swings in and now his eye's going to twitch for these little girls and freak out. I'm sorry, guys. This is just one of my favorite bits in the movie because it is just so perfectly timed. The tone of it is wonderful. Spider-Man. It's just one of those things that whenever this movie was being described to us during its production as very in line with John Hughes films, my first thought of after hearing that was, that's just fucking perfect. I don't think you could ask for a better tone for a Spider-Man movie than something
particularly, if you're going to go with the younger version of Spider-Man especially.
Yes, and I was glad Nick brought that up, because – that's something that we haven't really gotten to see in any of the previous Spider-Man films. We see him in high school in the original Spider-Man, the Sam Raimi Spider-Man film, and then we also see him in high school, at least in his at the end of his high school career in The Amazing Spider-Man. But it seems like every director who has taken on the character up to this point has just been in a real hurry to get past those high school years. They don't want to address it.
I think the reason for that is I suspect most people, especially older people that are Spider-Man fans, most of them probably grew up reading Spider-Man as he aged in the comics. And sure. So you think of those transformative issues in the 60s and 70s with, you know, Jerry Conway at the helm, where you see, you know, and Stan before that with Gwen Stacy's death and all of these huge events that made impacts on Spider-Man. So it's natural that I think you're going to want to use the version of Spider-Man that you first saw when you were a kid. So now we're seeing maybe a generation that maybe grew up reading Ultimate Spider-Man, or maybe, you know, wants to take it back to those – or do their own version. Everybody eventually does their own version of what Stan and Steve did. And I think in this case, it certainly was a decision that paid off.
Oh, absolutely. This was the smartest thing that they could have done, was putting him in high school and casting an actor who, while is at the time of filming this just barely over the age of 18 – he looks young enough that he could pass for being in high school for at least a couple more years. So you can get like one or two movies out of him playing the high school version of Spider-Man. And, you know, I think if he's, you know, not too jaded and worn out by the character by that point, you could have potentially a franchise that goes beyond just three movies. You could go into like four, five, six. You could go into a complete second trilogy where he's college age and older. Mm-hmm. And allowing this actor to grow up with the role, which would be a bold move, something that we haven't actually seen done in the MCU, and we haven't really seen done with many superheroes. No. I am very much looking forward to, because it's a ballsy decision, and I feel like for this generation of Spider-Man fan, hopefully this movie has made more Spider-Man fans, or made more people excited for Tom Holland's take on it, that they'll stick with it and they'll grow up with the character. And you know, much like those kids who were growing up reading the original Stan and Steve Amazing Spider-Man, as he aged through high school and then going into college, I can only imagine what it would have been like to be one of those kids reading that and experiencing that transition at the same time. So,
especially being able to relate to the fact that your mother, or your aunt rather, or your mother figure, as Aunt May was to him, had a face that more and more resembled a raisin. Now, okay, I want to talk about this while we can. The character of Ned Leeds, as Russell referred to him, Gonke, earlier, this is an interesting thing, because Nick, you are the biggest Ultimate Spider-Man fan that I know, and the character of Gonke, as I understand it, is the best friend character of Miles Morales.
Yes.
Okay, so for people that aren't familiar with Spider-Man lore, Ned Leeds was a pretty dear character in Spider-Man lore, had absolutely nothing to do with being Peter Parker's high school buddy. None of the characteristics of this character in the movie. This is, for all intents and purposes, Nick. Now, correct me and if I'm misspeaking here or if I'm oversimplifying, but this character is Gonke?
Basically, yeah. I mean, pretty much everything about him, whether it's the overweight Asian look of him, whether it's the obsession with Legos, whether it's the obsession with wanting to tell anyone and everyone who will listen Peter's secret, wanting to basically use Spider-Man as an excuse to have fun and call notoriety to he and Peter. I mean, the very personality of the character, it is Gonke lifted directly. They didn't really change anything at all. The only thing they changed was the name. Why? I have no idea.
What do you make – I have a buddy of mine who was chafed that they took Miles Morales' major supporting character and gave him to Peter Parker, a character that already has so many supporting characters, whereas Miles, Gonke, is one of his main supporting characters. This is a buddy of mine that's a very big Miles Morales fan, and – he was chafed about that. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I can understand it. Now, I would argue that for those who haven't read a lot of Miles Morales, the great thing about Miles is he has just as rich and deep – I don't know about just as, but he has quite a rich and deep supporting cast on his own. Both of his parents are still in the picture, which makes for a very different dynamic than Peter Parker. His uncle, who we see here in this movie, actually played by Donald Glover, is a pretty significant member of the supporting cast. And then you have other classmates outside of just Gonkei. Just Gonkei is his best friend, and by far, I would say, his most significant supporting cast member. But there are others they will definitely be able to pull from if and when they decide to go that route. And I am certainly hopeful that they will at some point down the road.
Yeah, it's just kind of a weird – there are a couple – and I think I'll get to them later on. But there are a couple of kind of weird character shifts to me that were unnecessary and that I didn't quite work for me. But that was one that I think – I don't have any connection to Miles, so it didn't bother me per se. But I think the idea of it did kind of bother me a little bit, in that you could have easily replaced this characterization with another and it would have worked as well. But maybe the thought was, there's no guarantee you'll get a Miles Morales movie.
Right.
And this is a good character, so let's take him and strike while the iron's hot, or while we have the chance, as the motto of Greg Berlanti on his TV shows is. So, yeah, so interesting stuff there. The Vulture, we mentioned earlier.
I love that fat kid version of hiding, by the way, just kind of slow.
Did with him in this movie is they did what I think most, not all, but most great villains do in these movies, which is they humanized him.
Mm-hmm.
By that opening where you establish that he's a blue collar. First of all, he's a blue collar person in a world that seemingly has no blue collar people in it. Everyone's a scientist or an engineer or, you know, everybody has an advanced degree in something. Here's just a blue-collar guy working to support his family, and you establish that early on, and you can kind of understand why he ends up doing the things that he ends up doing. You know, he gets screwed over on this business deal. He wants to strike back at what he thinks is a corrupt system and get enough to support his family. He's not out to get the big score. He's not out to ruffle feathers or anything. And you know, he goes too far. He takes it too far, but he seems to be out to do the right thing. We saw a scene a few minutes ago where he accidentally kills the original Shocker, which was a great scene. I thought this was the anti-grav gun. Now, the only thing I'll say about that, was anyone else taken aback by the fact that he didn't at all seem perturbed about having killed someone?
No. I actually thought it kind of fit with the character, because the character is entirely driven by his desire to provide for his family. And at this point, once Herman Schultz has made the mistake of even hinting about threatening that, while he didn't intend to kill him, I think he kind of views it as, you know, the ends justify the means, and whatever happens, happens to this guy, because fuck him now.
Yeah,
I think it kind of struck me a little bit funny, because in a movie that I think it works. I mean, it works. It was a good scene and really funny. But I think from a pure character standpoint, I was like, you know, I don't think that was the natural human reaction to having just vaporized someone. But that being said, I'm not criticizing the performance. I don't know. I guess in a different movie, it perhaps would have been explored more, but they're trying to keep it lighthearted, and I get that. So,
I'm not even sure if he's never killed somebody before. Honestly,
true.
That's something that we don't know what his full past is. So, yeah, it's not really out of the realm of a possibility, because he seems like the type who would, and I think it adds that extra layer of danger to his character, because we needed mm-hmm. we needed to see how he would react to being lethal. And that was an important moment in establishing his character, that part of his character. So whenever he and Peter come face to face, he's already killed someone before. It was somebody who worked for him. What's he going to do to somebody that is a genuine threat to him?
Yes. To quote Hollywood Hogan, "If I just did that to my best friend, brother, what do you think I'm going to do to you, nature boy? Woo!"
And Peter's not even bringing him a birthday cake.
No, he's not. Nick, real quick, how do you think the Vulture here compares to Hollywood Hogan in 96?
Not well, but no human being really compares to Hollywood Hogan in 1996.
What about Hulk Hogan from 1986?
I said human being, not immortal figure, Greg.
Ah, good point. Good point. So the usage of technology in this movie is obviously a big thing. We have the Stark Tech, the suit that Peter names Karen, that is a nice little ongoing, a little sad if you think about it, but also a pretty cool relationship with Peter and the suit. And in typical Stark Tech fashion, Karen actually seems to have more of a human personality than you would expect.
Yes, and she's very good. I believe it's Jennifer Connelly that does the voice of that in this film, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I was a big fan of his AI. I think that that was done incredibly well, and it's just hilarious to me that she has such a kind of a flirty nature with Peter, almost like she has a crush on Peter. It's an unrequited love, and Peter's just not really picking up on it.
I wonder if this could be like a Gideon and Rip Hunter situation.
That's kind of how I was viewing it. I was like, except in Rip Hunter's case, I think it was returned to a degree, but I think Peter is just completely oblivious. Like, it's not even a thought to him.
That would be the ultimate version of the Parker luck, to fall in love with something that you can never,
I mean, there are a variety of words you could use. I mean, procreate with, screw, take behind the food lion. I mean, like, any number of words, Greg.
Dance the horizontal bop.
The bop, yeah. That's one.
The horizontal bop.
Play bop. Hide the rainbow roll.
Indeed. So, Peter here... either is not picking up the signals from Liz, or is so consumed with his quest to do something cool as Spider-Man that he misses the signals here. So
it's the second one.
he's totally like, but he's also that high school kid. I mean, he's still a high school kid. He's never like really had any kind of interaction with a female that would, you know, help him understand what is happening here. So he's like, is she interested? Is she not?
Yep.
Am I in a position to actually find this out for sure?
He's suitably awkward.
Yes.
Oh yes. Yes. They captured teenage awkward, like angsty awkwardness so perfectly. I would have sworn that John Watts just graduated high school.
Yeah, that's something that we should also mention, and that I think it's a good thing in hindsight that the Raimi films and the Mark Webb films did not focus more on his high school-ness, because I don't think it would have been as good. I don't think they would have been able to capture it the way that John Watts captures it here. I think this is – but certainly, no question about it. Whether I would put it on the level of – the Raimi films or not, this was easily the best version of this high school Spider-Man that we've seen, because he's so awkward, because the entire his interactions with people feel so much more genuinely kid-like than maybe what you've seen both perhaps in the early Spider-Man comics and also in the earlier movies, where it's more of a self-serious take on life, I guess you would say, as a high school student. I think Peter here, as played by Tom Holland, captures the well, – I don't know about for you guys, but I felt high school was an immensely awkward experience.
Looking back on it now, it certainly was. Like, it's one of those things where even at the time, you're almost – too awkward to know how awkward you are, if that makes any level of sense. And you look back on the interactions you have and you almost cringe. And this certainly reminds me of some of these. So, yeah, you're right. He nailed it so well. Of course, I say that as a 30-year-old man. Like, you know, is this anything like what high school is still like today? I don't know. But I know it's approximating what I remember it being like.
Oh, sure. I'm sure that if we were making a movie about high school when we were in high school, it would be the most self-absorbed.
Yes.
It would be There Will Be Blood, essentially. lots of pensive staring, lots of brooding, lots of
masturbation.
Well, a whole lot of that, yeah. I mean, let's be honest. But I feel like a lot of this movie could be used as a metaphor for that. I mean, he shoots his webs out pretty frequently.
Mm-hmm.
pretty much every appearance of webbing throughout Sam Raimi's trilogy was a metaphor for masturbation, by his own admission, by the way.
Yes, yes.
That first time that Peter's webbing comes out, it does so involuntarily. And right after he has saved Mary Jane from dropping her food all over herself in the cafeteria. So, yeah, not so subtle there.
Kudos to them for making the vulture look cool, by the way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Seemingly an impossible task.
Well, this is one of those cases where, you know, going with the comic book iteration would have been the worst idea possible.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if there are still people out there, say, people that might have Captain Marvel in their Twitter handle that think that Marvel should have gone with the comic book accurate costume.
Oh, I'm sure that there are lots of people out there who will never make the concession that sometimes comic book accuracy is not going to work on film, no matter what. And, you know, I can't get on board with absolute comic book literalism because it just doesn't always work. And,
right. I think it's a case by case thing.
Yeah,
but
it is.
You know, you can't, it's like anything, but you can't, I mean, you just have to, there has to be a line there, you know. Now, that being said, I'm dug in on one character if they bring him into the MCU. They have
even
to
though,
get comic
even
book
though
accurate.
No human being has that hair.
I'm just saying, I wasn't even going to go there, Nick. I was going to go in a different direction. But while you're, yes.
Yeah, you were.
Basketball hair. Which I was going to say, by the way, I saw a picture of a real life person on the internet, and I can't remember who it was now, but I have to see if I can find it again, that had hair that approximates comic book accurate Osborne hair. They said it couldn't be done. Nick Duke on this very show said that it could not be done, but I've seen it. I've seen it, and now I just have to find the proof and send it to him via private message that no one else can see.
This is a great bit here with him trapped in the warehouse and talking,
oh, yeah.
You know, just kind of killing time, trying, you know, doing the nervous, pacey teenager thing. This is good stuff.
Oh, I was also going. I was going to use the hate monger as my my comic book accurate character. Have you guys gotten to the hate monger yet? I'm behind on my Marvel Age list. Now.
He's debuted, but he has not been on any of our reading lists, other than a brief cameo in the. In the wedding of Reed and Sue annual in Fantastic Four, number 3.
Yes.
Well, suffice it to say, he was a monger.
Of hate.
Of hate.
Yes, that's
yes.
True.
So, this is a good scene of Spider-Man killing time. To set up the big action set piece where he rescues his classmates in the Washington Monument.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that scene I also thought was very well done, the rescue scene.
Yeah, I was going to say you had to have liked that.
Oh, sir.
So your complaint then probably primarily revolves around, I'm assuming, the closing action sequence?
The climax of the film, yeah. The big – because I feel like, like any movie, it builds and builds and builds to what you presume to be the climax of the film, which it is. It's a climactic action scene that just didn't work for me. And honestly, I think that – One of my issues with the movie, where maybe it's not as I still like the movie. It's a very good movie, no doubt about it. But I think the action just feels repetitive to me in this after a while. I feel like there aren't the action pieces. And as I have been critical of other Marvel films on our list, in our watches of their action scenes, it's only fair that I can criticize this one too. Because the best way I can think of to describe it is – unimaginative. That closing sequence, I think it's boring. I think it's not very well shot in terms of the lighting. It's a little bit anticlimactic for me. And I know it's his first mission. It's going to be a little bit different than what you get if you had an advanced Spider-Man. But I can't, you know, it's not my job to direct the scene. I can just know off of the action movies that I've seen, and even compared to some of the recent movies we've seen in the MCU, even compared to the action sequences in Doctor Strange, which was a movie that, as you know, I was much lower on than anything else we've watched on our MCU watching to this point. I thought the action scenes in that were more interesting, particularly the fight scenes were more interesting than what you get in this movie. And I part of me thinks maybe it's because it's harder to get a Spider-Man fight scene. But no, I've seen really good Spider-Man fight scenes on screen before, really good Spider-Man action scenes on screen before. And I don't think that any of these, outside of this rescue and outside of that opener against the Avengers, really stand out to me as being particularly memorable.
The boat scene is fantastic.
Yeah, I was going to say that boat scene's pretty damn good.
Yeah, I wouldn't say fantastic, but I like it. It's fine. It's
no, the boat scene is fantastic because it shows you a hero who is basically killing himself, putting everything he has into it and failing. And that is the beauty of that scene. It is visually appealing, it is appealing from a character standpoint. Everything about that scene is great.
But again, also derivative, because to me it reminds me of the subway sequence from – or not subway, the train sequence from Spider-Man 2.
In which he succeeds.
Yes. This one he succeeds too, though. Well, he doesn't succeed.
He fails.
Iron Man succeeds for him.
He specifically fails, and then Iron Man shows up and has to clean up his dirty work for him.
Yeah. But regardless of success or failure, it's the same – not the same, but they're very similar scenes. And we saw him fail in the first movie. So like it's not like Spider-Man failing is a new thing. And I think – and that doesn't mean it can't be a good scene. But for me, the scene's a good scene, but it's not – again, it's not super original, except I do love how they use the Iron Man technology. Got to give him credit on that. That was a pretty creative use of Stark tech again. And I love the character beats that it sets up. But – you know, again, I don't know. I feel like the action in this movie is good, but not great. And the climactic sequence to me is the one, like you mentioned, Nick, that stands out to me.
I can somewhat understand on the climax because it's dark, it's like super CGI heavy, but. I mean, most of this movie is, but in that scene in particular, it's very noticeable. Like it stands out more so than any of the others. Going to disagree on the boat scene because I think the boat scene is fantastic. I also think that there's another scene that is not CGI heavy that actually is a callback to the a classic Steve Ditko moment that we actually just talked about on Marvel Age for this next episode in our first part of 1966, where Peter has taken on the Master Planner. He's actually kind of defeated himself in helping to and bringing down this building around their ears, and like pieces of it are on top of him. Villain's base is underwater, so he's got all these steel beams and everything holding mm-hmm. him down, and he's defeated. He's kind of he's beaten himself. And it's a metaphor for the weight of the world being on one's shoulders and him having to rise to the challenge to almost impossible odds. And in that same way, that scene is played to great effect in this movie, where he's been he let his arrogance kind of get in the way for a minute, and he winds up being trapped by the Vulture and left to die. And in that moment, he has to summon a will to live and a will to fight back against impossible odds. And I thought that scene was beautifully shot and rendered in a way that it was very classic Steve Ditko. And seeing that scene brought to life was absolutely tremendous. And John Watts deserves a lot of credit for putting that on screen so effectively.
Yeah, I agree completely. No doubt. That was a great scene. the imagery, the it's a great example of taking. We've seen this in some of the crappy comic book movies, but especially the great comic movies, taking this iconic scenery from the comics and filming it and recreating it in a way that feels like it's natural to the film, but also clearly replicating something that was once on the printed page. It's really cool to see. So yeah, I agree with you on that completely. And again, the boat sequence, like I said, I don't want to knock it. I think it was a fine sequence. It just didn't stand out to me, I guess, the way that it did for you guys. But Nick, your thoughts on that Steve Ditko scene that Russell?
It's great. You know, it's not action heavy, really. It's hard to classify it. You know, to lump it in here with the discussion we're having about action sequences, even though it does have physicality to it and has some effects to it. But it's really more of a character-driven moment, and it's just another thing in this movie that really hits at the core of what this character is and really works. I mean, I can't say it any better than that.
Well, while we're talking about things that – while we're talking about some of my quirks, I guess, about the movie – I mentioned earlier that there were a few character changes that did not work for me, or that did that bugged me a little bit more than they probably should have. One of them that I mentioned earlier was the Ned Leeds thing, which I just thought was more odd than anything else. I will also say that, and I've talked to Nick about this off the air, and I'm sure it's not a very popular opinion, but I'll express it on the air as I have off the air. Every time I watch this movie, I find Ned to be more and more annoying. And I know that's not the idea. I know it's supposed to be quirky and all that stuff. But for me, every time I watch the movie now, I like so much of it. And then I find myself cringing when he's on the screen because I just get annoyed. And I'm not sure. I don't know how to quantify that.
He's your Luis.
He is. Yeah.
Yes.
Great example. Hey. Yes. That's he's a
– absolutely, you're Luis, because that's how I feel about Luis every time I watch an Ant-Man movie.
Yep.
Right, exactly. Perfect comparison. The way that you guys view Luis is the way that I view Ned, where it's just like as soon as he's on there, I'm like, oh, my God, please, can we move through this and get to the next scene? Can we get to the next scene that doesn't involve him? So he annoys the hell out of me. I don't like him. I'm just putting it out there. So that's one. The other one I want to talk about that I think is more this is probably the nerdiest of my complaints. I kind of feel like Flash Thompson being a jock is essential to his character. I know that this version of Flash is an antagonist to Peter as well, which is the ultimate idea. Comes up with the super clever nickname Penis Parker, which sounds like a Nick Duke nickname that he would have come up with in college. But I don't know. I know that this is a hill that is I'm not going to die on per se, but it's just one that I don't know that jocks versus nerds will ever not be a thing. I'm pretty confident that it's still a thing today, and I don't know the reasoning for not doing that other than to say that we're doing something different.
Well, when you're in the context of a magnet school based entirely around science, everyone is a nerd. So you couldn't have dumb jock Flash.
Why do it in a magnet school instead of, you know, a normal high school like every other version of Spider-Man?
To provide a little bit of a different context and a different take on it, because as you said, after it's been rebooted or going on your third franchise in less than 10 years, if you go from Spider-Man 3 to this, you need to update the setting a little bit. You need to freshen it up a little bit. And something else, the magnet high school aspect is something that also has worked very well for Miles Morales, and I think they were looking to that for some inspiration.
Taking more elements from Miles, yeah. Right. Yeah. But I don't know. It's – I just feel like you have to have that – for Flash Thompson to be Flash Thompson, that's him to me. I don't know. I guess I'm in a minority of one on this one perhaps, but it's just my
– As long as Flash is a douche, quirk. And he certainly is in this movie, that's really – all you need to be Flash Thompson.
I was going to say, that's my interpretation of Flash Thompson. I've seen him be like the gigantic jock as he was in the Raimi trilogy. I don't recall. Did we see him at all?
I don't believe he was in
The Amazing Spider-Man. Yes.
What, was he?
Yep. Because remember, he was going to break Peter's camera at the beginning of the Amazing Spider-Man 1.
That's right.
And then after Uncle Ben died, Peter slammed him up against the locker, and Flash actually had kind of a human moment where he like, hey, man, I get your uncle died. You're going through some stuff. I'm sorry. I'm sorry for everything. Like, kind of to try to apologize for his behavior in the past.
That's right. He had a really good scene there, and it completely slipped my mind.
And then they even played up the Flash fan of Spider-Man from the comics, because at the end of the movie, Flash is walking around the school with a Spider-Man t-shirt on.
Yes. So you recall that movie way better than I do.
I watched it probably 5 or 6 weeks ago after we did our Amazing Spider-Man 2 podcast. I went back and watched the first one. So
that's it's all good. Yeah, his this take on Flash Thompson is very different, but much like many things in this movie are very different from the more traditional take. But the thing is, we had just had two separate movie series that went for a more traditional take. So personally, I was ready for something that went for something a little out there. And having been kind of in the midst of my own reading of Ultimate Spider-Man around the time that this was coming out, I gotta say, it was really hitting for me, because Ultimate Spider-Man had kind of become a legit favorite of mine. I'm still going through the process of reading it now. I'm into the 2009 to 2011 reboot series. I'm about halfway into that now. The artwork's not as good, but the writing is still solid. It's still good stuff. It's still it's on the strength of Bendis alone at this point. But seeing those elements find their way into this movie series, it largely worked for me. And I'm a Ned fan. This version of Ned, even though personally I'm like, couldn't we have just called him Gonke? Why did we have to call him Ned Leeds? Because whenever you say Ned Leeds in my mind, I automatically go to Hobgoblin.
Right.
and that's not –
Who is a character that we haven't even seen in a movie to this point? So.
Yeah, and I'm not entirely sure that they're even going to bother going the Goblin route, because as it's been strongly hinted rumored, the next movie is going to be a Mysterio movie. And
which is pretty shocking, because they're going to have to really sell me on a 5'4" wrestler being a foil for Spider-Man.
Well, how about a very attractive bearded man with a fishbowl head?
Better. I like it.
Okay. Maybe that'll work, depending on if they go with the Ultimate version, who has a very different look. I want fishbowl head, personally.
But I bet he'll have multiple looks in the movie, and you'll get both.
Probably,
is my prediction. At least for a moment,
or a completely redesigned look, all they did with the Vulture.
Yeah.
Come up with something totally new, and we're
they
on
can
that.
Make him. They can make him a really old man that also has a fishbowl head.
There we go. Put some old man makeup on Jake Gyllenhaal. That'll work. age him up to be, like ancient, like the actual Adrian Toomes ancient. That would just be awful. It's not awful. Donald Glover in this scene.
Yeah. Great.
I think he's actually pretty great. And I'm really hoping that as this movie series moves along, that he'll be back and we might even get a little Prowler action, which I would be very in favor of.
Indeed, and the other high school, I think, drawing it back to that, the other high school character, prominent change. Well, Liz Allen. Liz Allen's different, but I think Liz Allen serves a pretty important purpose in this movie, and they do a great job with her. The other one that we'll just go ahead and get to did not work for me, and hasn't worked for me in any of my. This is the, I think, the fifth. Fourth or fifth time I've watched the movie, and I don't find myself liking this anymore anytime I watch it, is this version of MJ. Now, this was another thing that was a kind of surprise at the end of the movie, where we find out her initials are MJ, whether she's supposed to be Mary Jane Watson, I don't know, or their version of it, I guess. But
well, her name is Michelle, so –
Michelle, right.
Yeah, so she's not per se – Mary Jane Watson feels more like
just their own character, like something that they wanted to channel, and maybe that's them signaling that they have no intention of putting Mary Jane Watson in this movie series at all. And we don't know how that character is going to evolve. I mean, it's also probably a signal that they're not going to put Gwen Stacy in this movie series, because
yeah, I wouldn't expect that. Yeah.
This character of Michelle really reminds me very much of Ultimate Gwen Stacy, and that they're giving her the MJ name, but giving her the Ultimate Gwen personality kind of sets my mind to, okay, this is going to be the girl that Peter winds up with. Her character is going to evolve over the course of these movies. And she's a stand-in for both of the more well-known loves of Peter's life.
Yeah, and I guess my problem with it on each rewatch is twofold. Number one, I guess I would have preferred like a version of either of the traditional love interests in terms of this version of the character or this version of the love interest for the future potentially. Didn't really do much for me. And the other problem, the bigger problem for me is I think the performance is bad. Especially the most recent rewatch I did of it, she comes off to me as if, you know, and there's a couple of times where the kids in the movie come off this way, but I think she, more so than any of the other ones, comes off as if it is obvious she's playing a character. What I mean by that is when you see a good performance, they draw you into the role and you believe that either you believe that the actor has become this character, or you're so engrossed by the emotions that you can look past the fact that it's Jack Nicholson playing Jack Nicholson again because he's freaking intense and he's believable. There are times with facial expressions and delivery of lines that to me it comes off like someone playing a character. Nick, I know for years this was something that you would say about The Miz in wrestling, that it felt for a long time like he was a guy playing a wrestler rather than a wrestler. And I think while – certainly, hopefully, I believe her name is Zendaya, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Can grow into this role and get better as she goes along. I think in the combination of her performance and this particular characterization, particularly when she's surrounded by, I think, really good performances from Liz, from certainly from Peter, and even from Ned. It just stands out to me as a something that is hard for me to buy into, I guess. Particularly the end of the movie MJ reveal for me really leaves me flat. But what about you, Nick? I haven't heard your thoughts on the MJ situation.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I just wish they hadn't done the MJ reveal at the end, because it really does feel like a completely different character, a completely distinct character. And I know Russell brought up the comparisons to Ultimate Gwen, but I would argue that Ultimate Gwen even has some major differences from the character in terms of this is a character here in Michelle who is portrayed as very laid back and very laissez-faire and almost views herself above normal discourse, whereas Ultimate Gwen is very fiery and has a passion and has a sassiness about her, a geekin' sassiness about her, if you will, that leads her into these very intense, you know, antagonistic relationships with pretty much everyone at first before eventually becoming closer to, you know, Peter and Mary Jane and that supporting cast of characters. But, yeah, this version, this Michelle character, you know, I'm not going to knock the performance that much just because, like, I think, Greg, in your criticism of her, I think you oversell how much she's in the movie. Because, like, she's really not here a ton. And it's to the point where if they hadn't done the MJ thing at the end, I probably would have just forgotten about that character altogether. She really doesn't matter in this movie, and my concern is she's going to matter in other movies. That's the only aspect of the build to the sequel that I'm not looking forward to, is the expanded role for her.
I think the she's not here a ton, but she does have some major moments in the movie, particularly in the rescue of the Washington Monument. She has prominent lines there. She's in the background of these scenes a lot, making, you know, obviously stalking Peter essentially. And it's just her delivery of things is just very, she's playing, it's like she saw a stereotypical slacker. It's like, okay, I've delivered my line. Like, I think a slacker might deliver their line. And it comes off as very forced to me.
You know, this scene is great. I'm sorry. I got to go back to this. Yeah. This is awesome.
Which one are you on?
We're on the ferry. Boat.
We're on the ferry.
Right? Yep. Mine cut out a little bit, so I skipped ahead, and I'm like a half second ahead of you guys. So
is that 98% successful? Yeah. And that's when you realize that everything has just gone terribly wrong. And
everything's about to go to hell. Yep. Good stuff.
Yeah. And I actually really like the action sequence that led into this when he's taking out the goons, taking out all the different little thugs. And probably one of my biggest concerns of the movie was the introduction of the Scorpion that we just saw actually here on the ferry. He's going to show up again later in the movie or in the post-credit scene anyway. And I am not digging that take on him, but mostly because the guy playing him just cannot act. You want to talk about a terrible actor, it would be that guy. He would be my pick for worst delivery in the film. But it kind of sounds like he's not going to be the primary antagonist of the next film, so I'm not really all that concerned. And there's always, you know, time to recast if need be. And I don't think anybody would really notice. So that would be my hope. And it's kind of interesting here that after all the Civil War stuff, people are still cheering Iron Man. Iron Man hadn't stopped being a hero to these folks, yo. And the fact that he saves this ferry is probably only going to help that. So here we are, end of the ferry scene. Thought it was great. Yep, I'm with Nick on this one. This is a great scene. And I especially love this bit after it when Peter and Iron Man, like, he's standing in front of the Iron Man armor thinking that, just like it was when it saved him from the lake, that it's just a drone that Tony's not really there, and then it opens up and Tony steps out and gives him this. He gives him a real dressing down, and that's
how hot would that have to be in a full suit inside the Iron Man suit?
Almost unbearable.
I'm sure he's AC going inside the Iron Man suit at this point. Like, he's probably quite comfortable in there.
I mean, no doubt. No doubt he has enjoyed some air conditioning in there. I'm sure that he can actually pee in that suit. And it'll be fine.
Probably filter it into a cup and drink it. Yum, yum.
Yum. Don't tell him you can't pee into a Mr. Coffee and get Taster's Choice.
Right. Well, with all that being said, we've kind of been over a large swath of this film, and I guess now would be a good time to start bringing it home.
Coming.
So, you know, I've kind of been over my nip. I really do like this movie a lot. It's a good movie. I'm a little bit lower on it than I think the rest of the panel. Just my nitpicks that I mentioned, action, some of the character changes didn't work for me. The Zendaya performance I didn't think was good. And the climax. But there were so many great scenes. I haven't talked about it, I don't think, or maybe I haven't forgotten already, but the scene in the car.
We talked about that.
So good.
That's easily the best delivery of Michael Keaton in this movie, and I think that that's really the moment that it put him over the top as Nick rightly pointed out, a continuation of the string of good villains that the MCU has been enjoying for a while now. Mm-hmm. And Michael Keaton really brought it. I mean, really brought it home, because, I mean, as much as we complained for years and years about the MCU having a villain problem, I think those days are over. And Michael Keaton was a strong signal to the fact that, yep, we're on the upswing now, and it has just continued.
Yes, and I'm glad to hear that he is going to be making more appearances going forward.
Yes, very happy that he will. And that's another bold thing about this movie. This movie did not kill off its main antagonist. It's one of the few MCU films that didn't do it.
And so glad. Yeah, I'm so glad, because I think that if there's one trend the MCU needs to turn around, I think it's that one, because they've already taken so many potentially great villains off the board. by killing them off in their individual movies.
The one that still hurts the most to me is Killmonger.
Yeah.
Killing him off was a huge blow because that performance was just fucking amazing. Mm-hmm. But here we have, you know, Keaton is still going to be around. Who else we got that has survived recently? We got Mordo didn't die at the end.
Mordo is still around.
Dormammu is still technically around for Doctor Strange.
Zemo.
So Zemo is still alive, so we can absolutely – he's got to come back.
No doubt.
He was one of the absolute
We learned in Infinity War that Red Skull is out there still.
Yep, Red Skull could make a return. Of course, I don't see them killing off Thanos even in the next one. Whatever Avengers 4 is going to be called. So they're starting to
build their stable a little bit here. They're starting to build them up. And then, of course, you know, depending on what's canon and what's not, they could always still bring in the leader, the Immortal Hulk villain, the leader.
And why not? I mean, we recast the lead role in that, so there's always the possibility that we can recast that role, which I think they should.
Or you don't want to see Delmer come back and play leader?
Look, I like Delmer as much as anybody, but he was not convincing as the leader. I don't buy it.
He was a toad. with all that being said, let's wrap up our final thoughts on this one. Let's start with you, Russell, as the guest. Your thoughts on Spider-Man Homecoming.
This was exactly what Spider-Man needed. They figured out the formula to make him fun, relatable, and fairly comic book accurate and fit him within the MCU in a way that not only makes sense, but lays groundwork for his further adventures going forward. So this is a tremendous step forward for the character, for the larger MCU. And I would rank it as the second best Spider-Man movie ever made, second only to the immortal classic Spider-Man 2 from director Sam Raimi. So that's how high I am on this movie, and I will say that I feel like this film set up the character for what could be potentially a sequel that will surpass all Spider-Man movies that have come before it, simply because the groundwork laid here is so strong.
Very good. Nick, your thoughts on, generally speaking, on Spider-Man Homecoming?
I absolutely love it. Each iteration of Spider-Man on the big screen to this point has gotten closer and closer to the version of the character I most want to see depicted. And so this one further refines it and further gets closer to that and gives me things that I consider to be essential to my preferred version. It's going to elicit emotions in me that other versions of Spider-Man can't. And because of that reason, for me, it is my favorite Spider-Man movie of all time. And I'll be honest, it's not altogether close.
And for me, I've kind of been over it. I think this is a good movie. And I agree with what Russell said about this being necessary for the character, regardless of what my preferred take on Spider-Man may be. Because I'll go ahead and tell you guys and the world that I think I messed up your list, Nick.
You didn't.
Maybe I messed up my own list.
Yeah. You're good.
Anyway, my preferred take on Spider-Man, I like him a little bit older. I'm not as interested in the high school stuff. I like the older Spider-Man this is what I grew up with. However, this is what the character needed. I realize that now, even though I hesitated about it and groaned about it when I learned that they were taking him back to high school. It's a good movie. It's an exciting movie. It's got great performances in it from Tom Holland to Michael Keaton. And I apologize, I don't have the cast listing up before me right now, but the woman that plays Liz Allen does a great job. It's a really good movie. There are things about it that inhibit it, the fact that it's not my preferred take on Spider-Man, and the fact that I mentioned all my other stuff with it. So I like it. I'd have to rewatch the original Raimi Spider-Man to rank it in my Spider-Man listings, and I haven't watched that one in a long time. it's well below Spider-Man 2 for me, and well above both of the Amazing Spider-Man movies and Spider-Man 3. So I'm guessing it'll fall into that number two slot, but it's dependent. So yeah, we all like the movie, just to varying degrees. So now, all that is to set up, it's time for that part of the show where we go to our lists and our rankings, our ever-evolving rankings. And gosh, how many movies are we up to at this point?
16. This is the 16th Marvel Cinematic Universe film.
Where were you, ladies and gentlemen, when we first started Hard Travelers for Hire all those movies ago?
It's been 84 years.
If you're anything like me, pretty much the exact same place. But
that's not true.
That's true. I'm geographically moved. Just emotionally and mentally stagnant. But nonetheless, we are ready to unveil our rankings. But let's, before we get to Russell's, Nick's, and my rankings of these MCU movies, let's go to the critics and find out what the critics and the fans have to say about this movie.
Absolutely. And as we always remind you, this is a combination of the Rotten Tomatoes score, the Metacritic score, and the IMDb score. Each of those on a scale to 100, meaning that 300 points is the maximum. So from 16 to 1, at number 16, we have Thor the Dark World with 190 points. At 15, we have The Incredible Hulk with 196 points. At 14, you have Iron Man 2 with 200 points. At 13, you have Thor with 204 points. At 12, you have Iron Man 3 with 214 points. In a tie for 10th, you have Avengers Age of Ultron and Captain America the First Avenger with 215 points. At 9th, you have Ant-Man with 219 points. And 8th, you have Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 with 227 points. In 7th, you have Doctor Strange with 236 points. In 6th, you have Captain America the Winter Soldier with 237 points. And then at number 5, you have Spider-Man Homecoming with 240 points. This film checks in as a top 5 MCU movie to this point, according to critics. At number 4, you have The Avengers with 242 points. Number 3, you have Captain America Civil War with 244 points. Number 2, you have Guardians of the Galaxy with 248 points. And then finally, still the reigning and undefeated champion, Iron Man, with 252 points.
Now deliver that line as Paul Heyman.
No.
Fair enough. Well,
Mark Lesnar would have to come out and choke him first.
Oh my God, can that happen? Folks, I've never asked anything of our audience before. If any of you out there can arrange for Brock Lesnar, he doesn't have to choke Nick, but just to shake Nick, just violently shake him, I would pay you $15 American via PayPal.
Hey, Greg. $15. Greg spares no expense for the things
Listen,
he wants in life.
Brock Lesnar's all about the money.
Is everything okay at home in the old HTFL Shape Studios?
No, it's nothing personal. I love Nick like a testicle, but I'm saying that
is a deep love.
Do the same for me, if you had a chance to pay Brock Lesnar to shake me a little bit, wouldn't you do it?
Well, I'd pay him to do more than shake you, but that's just
now. Wait, just a minute. That's you're going too far now. Anyway, So let's get to the rankings. Russell, I know that I hope you've had time to put your list together. Sometimes we put people on the spot here, but let's hear to the best of your abilities your MCU ranks for our hard traveling chronicles to this point.
I will go. I think I like a countdown list myself, so I'm going to start at 16. So at 16, I've got Thor the Dark World. At 15, Doctor Strange. At 14, The Incredible Hulk. At 13, Ant-Man. At number 12, brace yourself, Greg, Iron Man 3.
Oh!
At number 11, Thor. At number 10, Guardians of the Galaxy. Number 9, Captain America the First Avenger. At number 8, Iron Man 2. Two.
Thank you.
At number 7, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. at number At number six, Avengers 2, Age of Ultron. At number five, the movie we just watched, Spider-Man Homecoming. At number four, Captain America Civil War. At number three, Iron Man. Number two, The Avengers. And at number one, still holding strong, and I don't see it being dethroned, Captain America The Winter Soldier.
Excellent stuff. Excellent stuff. Cap has a lock on that top spot on everyone's list right now.
Really
to this
does.
Point. I'll go next, and I'll start at number 16. And I have at 16 Doctor Strange, or in Marvel Ultimate Alliance, Doctor Strange. At number 15, The Incredible Hulk. At number 14, Thor: The Dark World. At number 13, Thor. At number 12, Captain America, The First Avenger. At number 11, Ant-Man. At number 10, Spider-Man Homecoming. At number 9, Iron Man. At number 8, Iron Man 3. At number 7, Iron Man Q. At number 6, The Avengers, Age of Ultron. At number 5, Guardians of the Galaxy. At number 4, Marvel's The Avengers. Man. At number 3, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. At number 2, Captain America The Winter Soldier. And at number 1, Captain America Civil War. Nicholas!
I am stunned you have Homecoming ahead of Ant-Man, given your relative nitpicks of Homecoming and your vociferous defense of Ant-Man over the years.
No, I like both movies. I think they're very similar. Those are two movies I wrestled with. Those two movies gave me something to wrestle with. Mm-hmm. Bruce Pritchard going into this. And honestly, I could go either way. There are some things that aren't amazing about Ant-Man that I can admit. But I think both movies have a lot of strengths. On this particular occasion, I gave Spider-Man the nod because I think that Spider-Man had a better villain, certainly. I think the villain helped it, and I think the fact that it maybe had a little bit more of a – it was a reclamation project, and I think in some ways was a little bit more difficult than what Ant-Man was trying to do. So I'll give it a slight edge, but yeah, I can understand you being surprised about that. But – it's possible for me to like a movie while also pointing out some of its flaws.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In any event, we'll go to my rankings. I've got at number 16, Ant-Man. And that's something that probably – wait a minute. It actually might change the next time whenever we get around to this. At number 15, Iron Man 3. At number 14, The Incredible Hulk. At number 13, Thor: The Dark World. At number 12, Doctor Strange. At number 11, Iron Man 2. At number 10, Captain America the First Avenger. At 9, I have Thor. I have Iron Man at 8. Guardians of the Galaxy at 7. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 at 6. And then at number 5, I have the film we just watched, Spider-Man Homecoming. I have The Avengers at 4. I have Avengers Age of Ultron at 3. I have Captain America Civil War at 2. And I have Captain America the Winter Soldier at 1.
Would you ever have envisioned a world 10 years ago?
No.
Either of you, where Captain America would be your top movie in a comic book movie countdown, where like the character of Captain America would be in your favorite movie in a 16-deep comic book movie universe, and that cinematic universe would be good?
Now, not just that, but he would be in 2 of my top 5. So, yeah, mm-hmm. That's not something that I would have anticipated, especially considering that I came down on the side of Iron Man for Civil War.
Mm-hmm. Same.
And still do. So it still kind of takes me aback a little bit that, yeah, Captain America has the better overall trilogy.
Yeah, it's incredible to think because I you know Nick and Russell, you both have strong connections to Spider-Man. I loved the Hulk as a kid, and of course I love the Avengers movie and I love the Iron Man movies. But yeah, it's amazing that Captain America, a character I never read as a kid, a character I wasn't interested really in reading as a kid, has been that good on the big screen. But testament to Russo's, and a testament to how good this MCU really is. I mean, going through that list of movies that we've just counted down, such a great journey to this point. I will go ahead and tell everyone that our Hard Travelers series is coming to an end soon. We've got a few more movies left to go, but it's not. We're not going to keep doing it infinitely. So it is going to be sad when it comes to an end, but it's been great because I don't know about you, Nick, but every month it feels like I'm reminded of why I love these movies so much.
We still have a little while left to go, I'd say, about because we have some theme months built in. Of course, the return of Walking Dead month in October, and to celebrate the release of Aquaman in December, we've got Aquaman month. So this will be going on a little bit
Aqua
further.
Aqua month.
Yes, Aqua month. So we're actually our schedule takes it all the way out to the release of Avengers 4 early next year. So we got some more time with it, but yeah, it's nearing its end. We are in the home stretch at this point.
Indeed so. Well, Russell, thank you so much for taking time your day to review Spider-Man Homecoming with us and give us your thoughts. How can people contact you on social media?
Hit me up on the Twitter machine at Russell_Sellers. And while you're there, also go and give the old Place to Be Nation Comics Twitter feed a follow. You can find it at PTBN Comics. And find out all sorts of fun stuff happening there. And you can find me, of course, lurking around in the Place to Be Nation Comics group on Facebook. It's wide open. Anybody can join. Just jump on in. And so long as you know you're not a Russian bot, and we won't boot you. We'll have plenty of good comics discussion going on in there about this episode, about other episodes of different shows, including Marvel Age, which you can also find myself and Mr. Nick Duke on. Between monthly and twice monthly, depending on how quickly we can get them out. But we're rocking and rolling on it. We just recorded part one of 1966. I figured that'll probably be up by this drops. And hopefully you'll have heard the ad that's going to be running, I'm hoping, on all of the Place to Be Nation pop shows for my upcoming 7-part monthly series called DC Post-Crisis Management, where I am going to be going through 7 of the biggest crisis-level events from DC Comics with various special guests, starting with, of course, the kind of the big daddy of them all, Crisis on Infinite Earths. That will be episode 1, and we will be moving forward chronologically from there.
And so, you will be joined for that one, I believe, by the big daddy of Place to Be Nation Pop himself, the manager. Yeah, is that correct? And
indeed I will. I guess I can go ahead and announce that here, that the manager, Todd Weber himself, will be joining me to talk about his favorite crisis event that also includes, as I understand it, one of his absolute favorite single issues of all time, as we will be going kind of for a deep dive on Crisis on Infinite Earths. So look for that one coming up in September, probably towards the end of that month.
That's right. For those of you who think we've been in Marvel overload lately with all the Marvel Age and Marvel Age masterclasses, we're going to show some love to the distinguished competition as well, as we love to do here on the Place to Be Nation Pop feed. Well, Russell, thanks again for joining us. If you want to, by the way, anybody out there wants to follow me and Nick, I am at gphillips8652. He is at NickDuke87. We are also in the aforementioned Place to Be Nation Comics group on Facebook. We are also big fans and proponents of you following PTBN Comics Twitter. And if the mood strikes you, you can reach out to the loneliest email addresses on the internet. You can reach out to GregP@PlaceToBeNation.com and NickD@PlaceToBeNation.com. With all that said, we are going to take a quick commercial break where you can hear about all our other great shows at Place to Be Nation and Place to Be Nation Pop. And when we come back, we will have reading and watching, and of course, we'll have the rundown. Stay with us, folks.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Police Foundation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PoliceFoundation.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Police Foundation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcasts, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, Worldcast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talking Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead,
as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans
with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows, plus others, available at PlaceFoundation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceFoundation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceFoundation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Hi there. Have you recently gone through a crisis? Did you find out your friends had been lying to you for years to cover up something they did? Have you discovered that one of your bitter enemies might actually be three people? Were you seemingly killed by a new god only to find yourself quantum leaping through time until you make it back to the present? Was your entire reality wiped out in a cosmic battle between two godlike beings only to be reborn, destroyed, and reborn again? Then join me, Russell Sellers, and my special guests as we help you manage your post-crisis life in DC Post-Crisis Management, a limited monthly series starting in September. We can't promise you closure, but we will try to avoid destroying your hometown and turning you into a homicidal maniac who wipes out time.
Welcome to the second half of the show, ladies and gentlemen. We thank you for sticking through the commercials and for being here through the first half of the show, which we've already recorded, of course.
Mm-hmm. And we have in no way made multiple attempts at this back half recording. This is, of course, our first attempt, and we're one for one.
Absolutely. With all that being said, we're going to cut all the rigmarole out. We're going to get right to it, to a little segment we like to call Read and Watching.
Reading and Watching. What have you been reading and watching?
Now, I have not read or watched anything comic book related that I can remember in the last 7 days. I wanted very much to read Doomsday Clock, but have not had a chance to either purchase it due to financial constraints or read it due to time constraints. So, Nick, what you been reading and watching?
Reading-wise, I didn't get as much reading done this week as I did last week, but I did carve out the time to read Detective Comics 983 and 984. These are the first issues of the Brian Edward Hill storyline, guest starring Black Lightning here, and it basically focuses on a new villain called Karma, who has come to Gotham to teach Batman a lesson, and that lesson and stop me if you've heard this one before, Greg, is that Batman's allies make Batman weaker. That is only literally the major criticism I have of this little story so far is that this villain seems very repetitive because it seems like we've beaten the, you know, Batman having allies is a bad thing story into the ground over the last several years. I don't really know that we need another story to retread that ground. But in any event...
you know what we could use instead? We could use a story to remind us that Batman can't be both happy and Batman at the same time.
Well, perhaps this story will disprove that notion by the end, Greg. Let's just wait and let's let it all play out. But in any event, it's a fine story. It's well written. It's a little bit younger version of Black Lightning than they have on the television show, which is a bit jarring at first to see. But still well done. Still seems to feature Cassandra Cain, which I was glad to see. And so far it's fine, but not up to the James Tynion in the fourth run in the least.
Yeah, well, I'm excited to read this. I like the writer a lot. Follow him on Twitter. Cool guy. And hoping to, you know, I'm probably never going to read it at this point because I doubt it'll be trade collected. But or maybe it will be with whenever the Outsiders series, I'm assuming, gets launched out of this. But we'll have to see.
They trade collect pretty much all of Detective Comics, so I'm assuming they will trade collect this at some point. I mean, it's two issues in, and it's very clear there's more story to go. So I'm.
Oh, I got you. So it is going to be a full arc. It's not just a two or three issue.
It feels like it's going to be a full arc. Yes.
Gotcha. Okay.
And then I also watched some more episodes of Jessica Jones. I think I'm up through episode 5 now of season 2. Still holding strong, still very intrigued by the central plot of this, which revolves around the company IGH and their role in Jessica's past and this killer of metahumans that it has seemingly spawned. So still waiting for all the pieces to be put together, but great performances, great writing, and I like the pacing of it thus far. So high marks for Jessica Jones season 2 to this point.
Very good. And anything else of note?
No, that's it.
Very good. What are your thoughts on Tim Capel's Kristen Ritter and Benicio del Toro theory?
I mean, it is what it is. It is what it is. I don't agree with it, quite frankly, because I don't want to have sex with Benicio del Toro.
Fuck, I'm learning a lot here today on this episode, such as your desire to say that on it.
I don't think it did, but, I mean, that was the clear, like, because wasn't that the super Christian Shawn Michaels, you know, character?
I'm taking
your joke to the logical conclusion. I'm sorry.
Oh, God.
What have we done?
What have we done to ourselves? Anyway.
The rundown.
Also in Sling Blade.
John Mayer was also in Sling Blade, and he was also in Bad Santa, one of my favorite films.
What was his character's name in Sling Blade? We should know this from the Facebook threads.
Morris something, right?
Morris something, yeah.
Not funny haha, funny queer.
Good Lord.
It was a quote from the movie!
Sure it was.
Oh my God.
Sure it
oh
was.
Oh my God, here we go with this.
We got us one of these... One of these here.
You know, Greg, I wish I could go back in time to the first half of the show to antagonize you in retaliation for that little snide comment right there.
Unfortunately, there's no technology that will allow you to do that. Nick.
No. Vaughn Cunningham.
Vaughn. That's right. Vaughn Cunningham.
Vaughn Cunningham.
And the other guy is the poet is –
Morris something or the other.
Morris the poet. And then there's the other one that I know is your favorite.
Did you know that that Lucas Black now as an adult looks like a real life Frankenstein?
Lucas Black's the kid?
Yes.
No, I don't think I've seen that kid since what was it, Tokyo Drift that he was the lead in?
There's a picture of him here on the Wikipedia, and he looks like a real life Frankenstein, like with the haircut, you know, that's kind of like jagged in the front, and his head is kind of like square shaped at the top. He looks like Frankenstein.
Good Lord. Nick, when are we going to do a Sling Blade podcast?
How about now?
I'm good with it. All right, folks. So we are scrapping the rundown this week, and instead we're going to be dissecting the Billy Bob Thornton film Sling Blade.
Look at him, Greg. Look at him right now on the air and tell me he doesn't look like Frankenstein.
Where'd you send it?
To your Facebook. Where do I send everything?
I have to open my Facebook now. Hang on. So, yes, Sling Blade, an American classic. And I would encourage everyone to follow the Facebook account, Carl Childers. Probably, and I think Nick would agree with me on this, arguably the greatest export from the region known as the Wiregrass is whoever is – oh, my God.
He looks like Frankenstein.
I can see it. He looks like – oh, my Lord. Oh, man. Yeah, Frankenstein and like a vaguely looks like an NFL quarterback that I can't place the name of right now.
He looks
now.
A little bit like Drew Brees, yeah.
A little Drew Breesian, yeah, but with like a Peyton Manning forehead.
Yes, with you mean a five head?
Anyway, yes, Sling Blade's a great film. Billy Bob. You know, Carl Childers is an iconic character that taught us all a lot of lessons we could learn to live by, such as that boy lives inside his own heart.
Hmm.
All of us can learn from that, but none of that has anything to do with comics, unfortunately. Although, if anyone out there from a comic book publishing company is listening, and I hope you aren't. I would love, and I'm sure Nick would agree, to write a Sling Blade comic book.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe mm-hmm. for like Boom Studios or something.
Yeah, it would be definitely be like a Young Doyle comic is probably the angle I would take on it.
Yes, and I would focus on his large collection of guitars and Cadillacs.
Mm-hmm. Now, wait a minute. Now, Doyle has not yet achieved the large collection of Cadillacs. He is an aspiring musician.
That's true. So a large collection of guitars then, and then what can he join with them? We don't know.
Abused women.
Of course, and as it turns out, nothing at all. Mm-hmm. Because, I think that would be a great framing sequence of we see an ambulance and a Hearst mm-hmm. driving towards the house. But anyway, we need to get to our weekly look at the news and notes in the world of comics. We need to get to our segment that we like to call The Rundown.
Welcome to The Rundown.
Boy, Nick, after last week's veritable heaven of news stories coming out of San Diego Comic-Con, bit of a slow week this time around.
Yeah, not nearly as much going on. In fact, this should be one of our shorter editions of The Rundown ever, probably, in the show's history.
Absolutely. And the one thing that I know of as a truism, though, is that brevity is the soul of wit. And
yes, it is, sir. Yes, it is. I agree.
We are going to get into our little list of topics here. We're gonna kick them on down the line here. So what we're going to do is we're going to start out with arguably the biggest story of the week, which is that after 25 long years, that's right, 25 long years, the Bongo Comics series Simpsons Comics is scheduled to end with October's number 245. And at the same time, the company's other title, SpongeBob Comics, easy for me to say, is taking an extended break. Simpsons Comics debuted in 1993. This is very bad news for Bongo Comics' existence. Their co-founder left last year to take over Mad Magazine. Disney, of course, is acquiring the Simpsons property as part of 21st Century Fox. Looks like this is the end of the line. And anytime a comic book publisher goes under, it's not a good thing. Competition. There's just it's not a good sign at all. And I haven't read a Simpsons comic since I was probably 9 or 10 years old. I was 9 when it launched.
Yeah, I've never read it. So
I'm sure I read some of the early issues when they came out. In fact, I know I did, but I maybe had one or two of these. So, but it's amazing that it's lasted as long as it has, and I know that it's the comic that launched the careers of several creators, including Gail Simone got her writing start on the Simpsons comic. So, yeah, kind of a surprising announcement coming out in that. Not surprising that it's being canceled or ending, but surprising that it's lasted this long, and surprising that it, I guess disheartening a little bit that another relic of the 90s comic book boom is finally passing away.
Yeah, I never read a Simpsons comic before, so you have even more experience than I do, but all I'll say here is, isn't it going to be weird in a few years to see Simpsons comics published by Marvel on our comic book shelves?
Yeah. It is. It's going to be strange. If that even happens. I mean, who knows if they even publish Simpsons comics.
Oh, it'll happen. It'll happen. It'll absolutely happen. Like, you know, with Fox coming under the Disney, you know, the Fox properties anyway, coming under the Disney corporate tree, they'll leverage that that bit of synergy, and they'll crank out some Simpsons comics by published by Marvel.
Well, with Disney now buying up seemingly every property in geekdom, who's going to be the next TNA, Nick, in the world of comic book publishing?
Well, I think Test and Albert are going to launch their own comic book publishing line.
I like that. Now, is this going to be like some sort of Beyond the Grave thing for Test?
Mm-hmm.
Or okay.
Yes, John Ritter is actually the financier of this operation.
Yes, and Albert's actually still alive, so he's going to leave his job at the WWE Performance Center and focus heavily on his creative role with TNA Comics.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. I like it. We also got news that another book that is well-regarded that Nick and I have never read, Lock and Key, has landed at Netflix for a 10-episode live-action series from Carlton Cuse and IDW Entertainment.
Carlton who?
Carlton Cuse.
Thank you.
4 months after Cuse and IDW's Lock and Key pilot was passed on by Hulu, in this Netflix deal, the Lock and Key scripts will be redeveloped, the series will be recast, and a new pilot will be filmed. Of course, it's based on the long-running IDW series, Lock and Key by
Joe Hill.
Joe Hill and Gabriel Rodriguez. Yes, this article that I'm reading cut out the name Joe from Hill, and he's just Hill.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. Nonetheless, that's happening, Nick. Your thoughts?
Never read any of it, so I can't comment too heavily from that perspective. But as you know, you alluded to, this is something that's kind of bounced around various studios and various stages of development for a long time. So just when it appeared it was finally dead, it comes roaring back to life. And here's hoping it that Netflix is the place that finally is able to see this to fruition.
Yes, and if it's good, Nick, we can add it to our list of comic book series that are well regarded that we haven't watched yet.
Yes, we will be sure to add it to that list, which we are burning through at the whopping speed of approximately 1.5 shows per year at this point.
Yes, about the same speed that you're burning through the G1 Climax tournament.
Hey, that's fair. That's fair. I got nothing. Can't refute that.
Great googly moogly. Where is this? There it is. Another thing happened this week. How's that for a transition? Another thing happened this week, and that is that Venom, I don't know, I looked at the word villain and said it, so I'll just have to own that.
Not a villain, the character anti-hero, Greg, get it right.
That's right, an anti-hero. The character of Jean Villain from The Expendables 2. No, Venom has a new trailer out that was released to the internet and other locations, presumably. And I have viewed it, and Nick, I understand that you have viewed it as well.
Yes, I viewed it.
Well,
I think we need to let you lead on this one because, like, I don't want it to come across as I'm defending the trailer, but I don't think my feelings about it were nearly as passionate as yours were.
Well, passionate's a strong word, Nick. I mean, I
okay, oh, it. Not passionate, but I don't think it soured me on the movie to the degree it did you. I think is my point.
Yeah, I thought it was better than the first trailer.
Mm-hmm.
However, still don't love the CGI. I'll just get to the point, which is that my main problem with this movie is how disappointing it is. In that, when this movie was announced, Nick, and you'll remember we talked about this on the show, pre-production, all of the buzz around this project was that Sony wanted to make it in the mold of the Fox movies like Deadpool and Logan and New Mutants and make it different. Make it something that wasn't the stand. It was outside the superhero box. In other words, the word that kept getting thrown around was horror. We're going to make a horror villain Venom movie that had elements of John Carpenter's The Thing. And while it's possible, and this is another thing that we have to caution people on, after Suicide Squad, I believe that the hard-traveling fanboys learned our lesson about being very careful about judging an entire project based on a trailer. But the trailers for this movie make it clear that this is not in the vein of John Carpenter's The Thing, that this is more in the vein of every superhero movie that's been made in the last 20 years. It seems anti-hero. But let's go down the checklist. Good-hearted lead character who's out to try to bring justice to the world? Check. Conflicted personal problems that involve being inhabited, gaining powers, in this case a symbiote, and at first viewing it as a curse but later learning to view it as a good thing, which he actually alludes to in the trailer at one point. Check. Incredibly generic businessman villain? Check. Vague government conspiracy plot, superhero route, and I guess it's just disappointing from that standpoint, and I'm not going to try to judge the movie based on my expectations of it. However, nothing in this trailer made me think, gosh, that looks like a good movie.
Not even the Ole Anderson Black Scorpion voice being used for Venom?
What I would have preferred is the Barbarian voice being used for Venom. Eddie Brock, you come over here. You jerk me off.
I agree with you. Like the story of this movie and most of the performances in it, outside of Tom Hardy, but I'll get to that in a second. Just look and feel very, very generic is the best way I can describe it. Just paint by the numbers, basic as hell. I think what is ultimately still the appeal of this for me is that I was a kid who thought the character of Venom was really cool, and I think that character and power set enables you to do things that are at least visually interesting. I'm not saying that the CGI was great or anything, even though I think, you know, there's a proven track record at this point that CGI and the finished product is typically at least a little bit better than what we get in the trailers. But, you know, like the one shot where Venom is standing on the table and he, like, both of his arms turn into the axes or whatever. Stuff like that. Like, that's going to be cool to me. Now, granted, that's going to be like 6 minutes total of screen time in an hour and a half, 2 hour movie. So who knows if it's going to work out, but there are going to be enough cool things in there that I'm probably still going to watch this. Meanwhile, Tom Hardy is a phenomenal actor, but what the hell is this accent he's doing? Like, he can do an American accent. I've heard him do it. But what is this? It is one of the more bizarre choices he's made, and I don't know, man. The Eddie Brock of this does not seem to make a whole lot of sense.
You mean what part? The good-hearted investigative reporter that wants to bring justice to the world, or the not of this world accent?
Yeah, or the I just ate a guy, and now I'm going to carry on a conversation with this lady that I know, just like a normal person.
I got a parasite.
Yeah. I don't know, man.
Weird. I hope it's good. We'll see.
It probably won't be, but, you know, whatever.
We'll have to go do a HTF at the movies when it comes out.
That probably won't happen, seeing as how it comes out in October.
Oh, yes, football season.
Yeah.
Which means Nick is not capable of doing anything else during the weekends.
That is practically what it means, yes. And you know what? I don't feel bad about that, so it's all good.
Well, you can tell us all about your exploits in your upcoming written pieces, right?
So James Gunn.
Oh, yes. Yes, that is the other story of the week. So last week we talked here on the show along with Ben J. Morse, at Ben J. Morse on Twitter. He joined us to discuss our thoughts on the James Gunn controversy. He, of course, the director of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 1 and 2, removed after old tweets of his surfaced. He did apologize for those tweets all the way back in like 2012, I believe. But nonetheless, and he has apologized again and taken his lumps on this one. The newest on that is that the cast of Guardians of the Galaxy released a joint statement on Twitter this week. And basically, all of them signed off on it, the main cast members. And it essentially affirms their support for James Gunn, what a good person he is, the fact that they don't endorse the jokes that he made, but that he has apologized for them. They believe him to be sincere, and that he has done a lot for their personal lives and for other people, and has grown a lot as a person. Meanwhile, Variety cites unnamed sources who say that there is a growing feeling that Gunn could return and be brought back to Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, which is an idea supported by Chris Pratt openly. According to the quote here, sources say there has been a growing feeling that Gunn could be reinstated, especially because Marvel and Disney have been unusually radio silent on who could replace him since the firing. Production is slated to start at the top of 2019, and following Gunn's removal from the film, it was thought that Marvel and Disney would need to move quickly to replace him, since the replacement would likely have to do some work on the script. Prior to his exit, Gunn stated that Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 was scheduled to be released in May of 2020, and that he recently completed a first draft of the script. It's kind of the same situation we were in last week, Nick. I don't really know what to say about this because it's a complicated situation and feels like it would take a while to sort of get into the nuance of it. But all I will say is, taking into account everything that we know, not looking at it in a binary way, because, by the way, I understand the bad look of all this. I understand the situation that Disney is in, and at the time I agreed with their decision-making process from a PR standpoint. But I have to say, from a fan's perspective and from my personal perspective, I would like to see him get reinstated because I think the movie, the series is so fundamentally tied to his vision, tied to his storytelling capabilities, it's his story. And I don't think it would be the same in the hands of anyone else, including any of the names that have been mentioned to this point. But I will understand if it doesn't happen as well. Anyway, your thoughts?
Yeah. It's kind of weird to hear that it's already a possibility. Now, granted, it's the, you know, anonymous quote sources that are saying this, but yeah, I was kind of surprised to hear that it was already a possibility they might be brought back. And I wonder if the thing that is really swaying it isn't so much the fan response as it is the cast response. Because Disney and Marvel, by proxy, wants to have these long-term ongoing relationships with these cast members, and I don't think they're really high on the idea of souring those relationships or damaging them in any way. And I wonder if perhaps that's not the driving force behind at least reconsidering.
And as we talked about last week, this cast, more so than many of the other casts in the MCU, is particularly tight-knit. And in addition to that, one of the biggest, literally and figuratively, members of the cast, Big Dave Bautista, can be something of a hothead at times. So if with the potential of the original cast of Avengers leaving the MCU, I don't know that Marvel would be super excited if some of their most bankable other cast members decided to walk away. Not that I'm saying that would even happen, as we talked about. All this discussion was done more in depth last week, but nonetheless, it's an interesting situation. And what do you think is going to end up being the result of it? Do you think he comes back or not, or is it too early to tell?
I think it's too early to tell, but if you put a gun to my head, I would probably say he winds up coming back.
That seems to be the way the winds are blowing. I know off the air I told you that I would be surprised if he did come back. This was last week before I got this new report came out. But I guess I'll stand by that just because perhaps working in public relations has made me averse to the slightest possibility of backlash for something.
There you are, Greg, being afraid of controversial statements again.
Riding the fence. Yes. Nonetheless, I just got a very cryptic text message. I'm trying to discern what it means. Nonetheless, where was I at? Where were we at? The rundown. We finished the rundown, which means that it's time to put a minute on the clock as I go to my stopwatch, Nick. You know what this means. It's time. Once again. For the Wrestling Minute. So, Nick, what are your thoughts on wrestling this week?
Wrestling is a thing that exists.
It is. Professional wrestling. It is worked combat between two athletes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The Brock Lesnar stuff on Monday Night Raw was very strange to me. Although it seems, at least based on one crowd, to be getting the desired response. So in that regard, it's working, but it seems inconsistent with the character of Brock Lesnar that's been portrayed for the last 3 years. But I guess that doesn't really matter, seeing as how he's apparently on his way out of the company. So I don't know. Thumbs leaning towards up as it relates to Monday Night Raw, as it relates to the G1 Climax. I haven't watched any more of it, so got nothing for you there.
I've got echo Nick's thoughts on Raw, although it was fun to see Nerd Brock backstage briefly. That was good. As far as the rest of wrestling, Seth Rollins and Drew McIntyre had a great match on Raw that would have been perfect in the G1, which I have been watching. And they would have fit in alongside almost any of these
Take the pill, Greg.
Block matches here. And in addition to that, I thought that the G1 I've been watching – star of the tournament, Tomohiro Ishii. He has been outstanding. His matches with Zack Sabre Jr., his match with Goto that I mentioned last week, and then I watched just yesterday, I watched his match from over the weekend against Kota Ibushi, which was, Nick, one of the most ridiculous non-Shibata matches I've ever seen in terms of stiffness. It was uncomfortable at times, not in the same way as Shibata in that you're worried about grievous head injuries, but in the neighborhood of just two people hitting each other in the chest and neck area, for God's sake, so hard that it defies belief how it was worked. But nonetheless, an outstanding match. A strong case could be made for it as the match of the tournament so far. I don't know. I'd have to go back and really re-examine things, but great stuff all around. Ishii, Naito, and Sonata have stood out over the last several days.
Absolutely.
And that's the Wrestling Minute. Went a little over again, but that's all right. With all that said, I mean, gosh, we've got such a loaded month coming your way, Nick. Coming your way, ladies and gentlemen. Don't we, Nick? That's better.
We sure do, Greg, and it's going to, you know, you're just going to have to wait. You're going
to
have
to wait and see.
Let the anticipation build over what exactly that entails.
Because the thing about us, the one thing that's for sure about the hard traveling fanboys
is nothing's,
For sure.
That's right.
Absolutely. So we would like to thank you once again, ladies and gentlemen, for listening to the longest running weekly
episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation.
And we invite you to listen to all the other great podcasts here at Place to Be Nation Pop. We invite you to stay tuned for some important and special announcements related to Place to Be Nation and its various podcast feeds. And we also invite you to join our Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page and follow us on Twitter at PTBN Comics. Until next week, so long, everyone!
She tried to hide it by the faded denim clothes she wore, but I can tell across the bar this gal was just a whore. She said, "You've got me figured out, but I'm not what I seem. And for a beer, you'll get inside these tight-fitting jeans." I bought that gal a beer and we checked into a room. All she did was lay there and I finished much too soon. I can't say that she's the best I've ever held or ever seen, but there was more than pussy in those tight-fitting jeans. It started with a jock itch and progressed right to the drip, and I broke into a cold sweat every time I took a piss. As I sweated out my blood tests, before my eyes it seemed a tiger came alive inside those tight-fitting jeans. They gave me lots of pills and all those shots that I went through. By the time the worst was over, my ass was black and blue. When I thought that I was well, I started losing all my teeth. Just one more thing she hid inside those tight-fitting jeans. She ain't never been no lady, and that's all I'm gonna say. And she cost me more than money by the time we parted ways. 'Cause I've had more penicillin than most guys have ever seen, courtesy of one smart bitch in tight-fitting jeans. Now she's gone back to her world, and I hope to hell she stays. 'Cause about the only thing she didn't give me was the AIDS. Yes, I used to like those cowgirls when they're sassy and they're lean, but now you can piss on all them tight-fitting jeans.